Chair Anderson and the fellow legislators for coming up to our part of Minnesota, and especially the folks out there took time out of today to listen to us, provide us with some input. It's really important because normally these kind of sessions, hearings are held down in St. Paul, and it's more than a few minutes drive from here. So again, thank you everybody for coming and showing up.
And I'm going to have the rest of the members introduce themselves as well. Representative Nelson,
you
want to start us off?
Hi, I'm State Representative Michael Nelson. I'm from Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. I represent the southern half of Brooklyn Park. I've been in the legislature. This is my seventh term, so glad to come up with it. Nice drive this morning.
Representative Johnson.
Hello, everyone. I'm Representative Sheldon Johnson. I represent the eastern part of St. Paul. And had a nice drive up here crossing the Mississippi River a couple of times, and it's very great to be here, and appreciate you being here as well.
And I'm Representative Lyndon Carlson. I represent parts of three communities, Crystal, New Hope, and part of Plymouth. Being that Representative Nelson mentioned his years of service, I'm in my 22nd term, 44th year. Used to come up to this part of the country quite a bit. My grandparents had a lake place just north of here between Backus and Hackensack, and summers literally grew up at their lake place. So we would make it down to Brainerd and through Brainerd on our way quite a bit. So quite familiar with the region.
And just to kind of give you an idea, the State Government Finance Committee has several different items that we're responsible for. From our budgetary perspective, we have accounts such as the Veterans Affairs account. We have, and that's really with everything from services to the homes and so forth, that's not covered on the federal level. We take care of the state level side of things. We also are responsible for state agency budgets such as the Department of Administration, our Department of Minnesota Management and Budget. Those are the folks that put together our budget forecast that we will actually have tomorrow. We'll probably read about it in the paper. And then a host of other different items. Those are kind of the big ticket. We also have the Department of Revenue is another agency. We're not in charge of the taxes part of it, but we're in charge of the agency budget itself. For today's purposes, what we're going to be reviewing is we have asked the legislative auditor. That's the auditor that is accountable to the legislature. Ask them to do a review of the state auditor and how she performs audits for counties and whether those audits have been effective and cost efficient. And so we've received testimony from the legislative auditor on the state auditor, and we've also received a lot of feedback from our county auditors because last year we passed a law that allowed counties to have audits performed by a certified public accountant. This is the same flexibility that we already provide to cities and to school districts, and 22 counties already have that flexibility. What we did in changing the law was to extend that to all counties, and counties just want to have the option. They can either choose to stay with the state auditor, or they can choose to have a CPA provide those services. And we did that to just give them the flexibility. Some have found that they have been able to get their audits done for a cheaper cost, which of course saves you the taxpayers' money. But I have asked your local county administrator if you want to come forward at this time and share with you your perspective on hopefully the report.
And then we would be appropriate for the Pledge of Allegiance, would it not?
Oh yeah, that would be very nice. Yeah. You know what, we forget that because at the legislature, every time we have a House session, that's how we start our day. We don't necessarily do it for committees, but I would welcome the opportunity. Do we have our plan?
Sure.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And then just for folks to understand kind of how we operate, we are required to have a tape recording of this committee hearing. This is an official committee hearing. So for preservation's sake, what we do is if anyone is interested in commenting on something, you need to be recognized by the chair, and then you need to come to the testifier's table, and what you need to do is state your name, because then that way we have that for the records for the state, and that way if anybody were to come later and say, you didn't record this, we do have it recorded, this is available to all the public, and so we want to make sure that we preserve this record. So with that, if Mr. Poole, if you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is Tim Hool. I'm the Crow Wing County Administrator, and the first thing I'd like to do is, on behalf of the Crow Wing County Board of Commissioners, welcome you to Crow Wing County.
Thank you.
We are thrilled to have you here today. Crow Wing County's mission is to serve well, to deliver value, and to drive results. And so while you're visiting us here today, if we don't live up to that mission in any way, we would be very interested in knowing. And so I'll be around for a little while, but certainly Representative Heintzman and Lewitt know how to reach somebody in this courthouse. They visit here often. I hope that you get a chance to come back to Crow Wing County often. We like to think of ourselves as one of Minnesota's favorite places. And in February, that might be a little bit more difficult of an argument to ply than it is in June, July, and August. We have some of the best golf courses in the state of Minnesota, so if you're interested in that, we have recreational opportunities coming out our ears with our lakes. We have a mountain bike trail out in the Cuyuna Lake or Cuyuna Regional State Recreation Area. And so we'd really like to invite you to come back and come early and come often. Also want to welcome...
Mr. Poole, if I could stop you a second, too. The best thing that I had in my drive today is there's a road that says halfway crossing. And I thought, well, we're halfway to Breeder. It was about that point in my trip. So I think you guys do a great job of advertising your community. I don't think that was intentional, but it worked for me.
I know where that sign is, Chair, and you're halfway to God's country.
There you go.
I'd also like to welcome our guests here today, those that are going to testify before the committee, the veteran organizations, and hope that we will live up to that mission for them as well. The other thing I would point out is I hope you have a chance today to just partake a little bit of our historic courthouse. This building was built in 1920. We don't build public buildings this way anymore. Italian marble on the walls, the Italian marble floors up in the atrium that was hoisted up into place by horses standing on the second floor of the historic courthouse to put that in place. It's a beautiful building, and for those of you old enough, this was a former courtroom, and if you remember the Marjorie Condon murder, Roger Caldwell got a change in venue, and that change in venue was held in this courtroom. So a little bit of history to partake in. I hope you get a chance to walk around the building. It's a great building.
Great, thank you.
On behalf of the State Auditor's Office, Madam Chair, if I could start by saying, I think the law that was passed by the legislature was a wise law. It allowed counties to competitively go out into the market to find out whether the state auditor could deliver our audits on the same time frame and or at the same cost. Those are the two criteria that I think are really important for counties. I would tell you Crow Wing County has had a state auditor doing our audits for years and years and years. They have a very capable, very qualified auditing crew. Audits are essential. They're not a burden. They're not an interruption in our work. It is a third set of eyes outside the organization that help to point out areas in which we can improve our operation to safeguard the public's trust. So we have no issue with the fact that we should have audits. We think it's a good practice to have audits. The issue for the Crow Wing County Board of Commissioners was simply a matter of, can we dip the toe in the market's water to see whether or not we could get our audit completed just as capably in an earlier fashion or in a cheaper fashion. The state auditor, not that long ago, did move Crow Wing County's audit up earlier in order for us to submit our financial reporting to the Government Accounting and Standards Board, GFOA, for awards of excellence, which we have done, by the way, the last 2 years for both budgeting and financial reporting. I'm pretty proud of that. The State Auditor's Office did accelerate our audit in order to allow that to happen. So there are no hard feelings at all between Crow Wing County and the audit staff that comes here. They do a really nice job. Here's why I think the audit is still a good law. And that is primarily because this horse has already left the barn. By that I mean, according to the Office of Legislative Auditor's report, there are 28 counties in Minnesota that are already using, with the concurrence of the State Auditor's Office, 28 counties that are already using private auditors. There are no school districts in the state of Minnesota that use the state auditor to audit that local unit of government. There are no cities in the state of Minnesota that use the state auditor's office to audit the books of those units of local government. The vast, vast majority of local government audits are already privatized. We have only 59 counties left in the state of Minnesota that don't already have a private audit. This horse has left the barn, and it left a long time ago. I think there is a proper role for the state auditor in the state of Minnesota to safeguard the public's trust. They ought to receive the local government audits from school districts, from cities, and from counties, and they ought to be reviewing those audits with care. And if in any case they believe that that local government audit was not done up to solid accounting practices, they ought to step in and require that it's done again. That safeguarding of the public trust is an important function. It is not a function to be taken lightly. This is not about whether or not 59 counties should have private audits. It's about where's the best use of our public resources. And in that respect, I think this horse has already left the barn. I am not trying to denigrate the state auditor's office, nor their crews, nor the quality of their work, nor how many staff they need to employ. I am simply saying there are only 59 counties left of thousands and thousands of local units of government in Minnesota that are already using private audits. Happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Poole. And I did want to recognize Representative Howe. He was the chief author of that piece of legislation that we're talking about. Representative Howe, everybody else has had a chance to introduce himself. If you want to comment on that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And as she said, my name is Jeff Howe. I represent District 13A, which is the southeastern part of Stearns County, and that's the city of St. Cloud. The reason I'm late, I was stopped. I'm still in the National Guard. I had to stop and sign some evaluation reports, and we've switched now. We have to do that electronically. And technology is great when it works, but when it gives you a hiccup, it took me a little longer to get that signed than what I anticipated. But I will tell you that I couldn't have. It seems like you were at some of those committee hearings because that's exactly. The main reason why we push this forward is because we believe that you know, there needs to be some accounting balance as far as some competition there, basically a price control piece. And it's not to say you're going to switch to go to a public audit or someone else, but because the state auditor, I agree, the those folks do a great job of doing it. It's just that I think there's nothing there to maintain price control, and this is a good competition, is good in this respect, my analysis. So thank you for those comments, and I think I'll let that go.
I know somebody from the back has their hand up. Did they want to comment on it at all, or did I miss? Okay. Any members, any other questions at all? Okay. I want to thank you. As Representative Howe pointed out, those are the exact reasons why we put this law in place, to give counties the flexibility. There is a lawsuit, for those of you that are not familiar, the state auditor has chosen to sue three counties, one of them being Becker, Wright County, and Ramsey County on this issue, which I think is really unfortunate, because, as you said, the horse left the barn. This is already being done across the state. And it would be better use of state tax dollars if we focus the resource on just making sure that those audits are being done properly and let you get on with it. And we do appreciate the work that you do as a county and the challenges that you face, and hopefully this will help alleviate some of those pressures.
Representative, I didn't happen to think of a quick question. Tuesday we were in Canyon County and the administrator there while the person testified that he on behalf of the county commented on what the cost of an audit had been and what the range had been over the last two or three audits. Would you happen to have that information with you? Or?
Representative Carlson, I would be giving you a ballpark figure.
It is what kind of ballpark range?
I'm a little reluctant, but I would say it's probably been around $50,000. I would say give and take considerable.
Yeah, Chairman, I assume just the way you said that, that's been fairly constant, then roughly $50,000 over more than one audit, or was that the most recent?
Mr. Cole, and what you could do, because you're giving the ballpark figure, if you wanted to go back and send that information to me, I'll make sure that it's disseminated to all the members, too.
From my perspective, Madam Chair, that's fine. 50, you know, give or take a little bit. That's quite a bit less than Candy Eye County shared with us, but thank you.
The comments that I received from them is it ranged anywhere from about $70,000 to $90,000. So it was $20,000 swing. And so some of the questions members had, I think Representative Carlson had them too, was how does this impact budgeting purposes? If one year it's 70 and then the next year it jumps up to 90, you know, what kind of challenges does that present for folks? So it was just kind of interesting. Every county has been different. So we're going to try and get a handle on just how the price structure works and how we can make that more consistent.
We have experienced the swings in price. There are some counties who I have heard express that if they complained about the price, then it went down in subsequent years. I think fundamentally, I don't know that that's true, by the way. Fundamentally, however, what I would suggest is the state auditor comes in and they're going to bill you on an hourly rate. And then they're going to decide how many hours it takes. Unlike going out in the private market, where you're going to put out a request to say, here's our organization, here are the audits that need to be conducted, give us a firm price. And if they spend more time getting that done, then it is at their own expense. If they spend less time and get it done to a high quality standard, then it is to their benefit. And so that's a significant difference in the pricing methodology that I think may be contributing to some of the swings. That is my opinion.
Members, any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that's one thing that I've looked at the controversy going on here is that the private sector can do that, do an RFP for a set price to do that, but currently our state law says the auditor has to recover the cost of what they do, so they have to charge what it costs them to do it. So I mean, if you're comparing using that as a criteria of cost, you've got two different methods of doing it, comparing apples and oranges in that case. Well, a private business can bid competitively and bid at a loss if they want to keep staff on during their slow times, make up so they have them during their busy times. So that's, and a lot of times businesses do that. So.
Well, Representative Nelson, I think it begs the question of how can we perform this service better and give greater confidence or security to the counties that this is what they're doing in their communities. They have to meet a budget just like we have to meet a budget. And any way that we can kind of work through that. So hopefully we'll be able to work through some of those issues here in this
discussion. Chair, if I may.
Mr. Poole.
Representative Nelson, I think you raise a good point. The challenge for us in local unit of government, we frequently have things that are very seasonal in nature. Snowplowing. Critical government service, we don't want to privatize it because it is a critical function of government. And so we staff for snowplow season in our maintenance department. What's the value that they can add in June becomes the question. And we have to face that issue. And so we put them to work doing value-added services during the non-peak times of the year. And I would suggest that's the model that the private sector is using for its audits. And then the challenge for the state auditor's office would be to find the value-added things in between the time periods when they are doing state audits. We face that challenge all the time and rise to it. And I think they should as well. If the law reads that they must recover their costs on every specific audit, then I think you ought to change the law. You ought to look at that at the macro level, not at the micro level. They ought to recover their costs for all of the audits. But they should have the flexibility to have a loss leader or to make more in some instances to make that up. If we're looking at it audit by audit, then you have handcuffed them and you ought to remove that handcuff. But I also think it is incumbent on them to find the value add for the non-peak season. We do that all the time.
And I think in that, I think those review audits, I think, is very important, that piece that they can do. Because I'm concerned that a few years back, when we had the auditor in front of our committee, I raised that very question about, because the school district that I graduated from ended up with an auditor that wasn't certified or qualified to do those audits, had lost his qualifications, but yet continued to do the audit for another decade or so before they changed auditors and the new auditor found that the financial secretary and the auditor had fleeced them they could prove $350,000 to the financial secretary and the auditor packed his bags and he's no longer in the state of Minnesota. So those are the concerns, and I think that's exactly the point that they could be doing is more reviews of those audits that are being conducted to make sure that they're also qualified and they're being conducted properly. And I think that's that value added, and I think that should be the main focus of their office. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
A question, though. You mentioned school districts and cities. I truly don't know the answer to this question, but counties under a uniform county system. We required, for many years I chaired one of the education committees or another, and years ago we required the school districts to be under a uniform accounting process. Some not me have raised that question relative to cities, and what's the standing of counties relative to uniform accounting? Because I think that does tie into perhaps auditing and auditing time and so on.
Mr. Poole, we also have Mr. Shepherd here. He might be able to lend.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Carlson. There are standards for accounting. There is the Government Accounting Standards Board, which provides a broad overview of accounting systems that all governmental agencies should be in compliance. There is a recent change in those standards, for instance, where we need to report our pension liabilities, the unfunded portion of our pension liabilities on our books. All counties in the state of Minnesota will comply in the same fashion. I wouldn't go so far as to say that that means that their everyday accounting systems, like how they get the bills paid, would be identical. There are a number of different accounting systems that counties use in order to have those processes. But at the end of the day, the audit has to conform to those generally accepted accounting practices consistent with the Governmental Accounting and Standards Board.
The reason I raised that question, when it sounds like that's more a voluntary kind of accounting system that the counties come under, as opposed to where UFIRS is very detailed, quite frankly, with school districts, and the state kind of gets down into the fine lines. But we're talking about audits and different costs of audits. If you're under different accounting systems, that might account for some of the difference. Because the state auditor said it was very difficult when he did his report to compare one county with another. Way back when, it was very difficult to compare the costs of one school district with another because they each had their own accounting system. And that's why a decision was made. I just happened to be on the committee at the time. Others, that it came from the Department of Finance and the Governor's Office, was an initiative to put them under a uniform accounting system. But I'm just curious, with relative to what counties, because we do hear about this variance from one county to another. Maybe that's a question at some point to ask the state auditor from my perspective when they're doing those kinds of comparisons or saying they can't really compare if that's part of the reason.
Mr. Hall.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I think there is an element of truth to that, that the school district does have more uniformity than counties do in their accounting systems because of that state requirement. And so I think that there is an element of that that could drive some differences from one county to the next. We could not choose, however, to not comply with the Government Accounting and Standards Board requirements for how we do our financial statements. I doubt the state auditor could force us to comply, but if we don't comply, it would be a notation in our audit as a legal non-compliance issue for every instance in which we don't. And then when we go out to the bond market to issue bonds, and if we had 27 legal non-compliance issues because we didn't follow the GASB standards, we'd be paying more on our interest. And so it is in our best interest to follow that framework. But I do think you are correct. That's a framework for counties and for school districts. I believe, I'm not an expert in school districts, but I believe that it is more standardized for schools than it is for counties. But there is still that broad framework. Our financial statements look awfully, awfully similar.
And I didn't mean that there wasn't the framework from your testimony earlier, but the school districts. But an audit extended out into the weeds, too, and that's why I was saying there may be some reason for the difficulty of comparing when you're doing an audit in terms of the time that it takes to do an audit with the difference in the accounting systems that a given county might have, even though they have a similar framework that you described. But thank you.
Representative
Lewis. Thank you, Madam Chair. Two points on that, and I speak now as a former consumer of those audit reports as a county commissioner, a little bit dated to a decade ago. But that those government accounting, their standard government accounting practices, one of the things you want to always have your heads up for and county administration is looking at is to make sure that when something changes, as you just mentioned, Mr. Moore just mentioned, There wasn't a standard requirement that anybody that had a retirement liability out there because they actually were going to be in the government was handling that, but that was put on the books so it was clear and you could see those liabilities out there sometimes for decades and decades. That's an example of standards that were not required. So everybody's under that. You know, that's, and that's point one. There are a set of standards, and as a local member of government, you always want to make sure, and that's part of what the audit process does, is if you're not complying, they'll tell you that in a microsecond, and it becomes an audit finding, and an audit finding is not good when it goes, instead of good bonding or anything else, you maybe need to correct it. The other part of that is, and I don't have a lot of empathy for the auditor's office in this area, and why they may have some struggle about complicated and it changes all the time and it's different is these commercial audit companies that do this, they look across the entire spectrum of business and no two businesses are identical, so they're used to being able to get in and look at something that doesn't look like the next one they did. I'll give you an example of Aiken County and Crowing County both have a very robust land department. There's other counties that don't have a land department. So when you move from county to county, there's quite a variation amongst counties. There's a reason why we have land departments because we own a lot of land, sometimes for a detriment, but that's another story. So you go someplace else where they have little or no land, there's no reason to need, that's an entire department. That's a $1 million part of most of these counties that are known part of Minnesota. You're not going to see that anyplace. In places we don't want to land. That's just one little example. Other places have a county hospital. Other counties do that. We don't. Another example. So there's this huge variation, and that's why it doesn't hurt to bring another set of eyes in that by their, what they do, they're used to looking across an entire broad spectrum of business entities with all kinds of different things. And so just that other look from somebody with different reference points operating under the same general standards. There's a real breath of fresh air, I think, for everybody. everybody in business probably ought to change their auditor about once every 10 years. Just make sure that you aren't doing things on half. But like I say, I consume those reports for a couple of terms, and they're only about that thick. And we as commissioners were held accountable at how we operated county government, and you know, that state auditor's report was kind of a big report card. But there's a definite set of general standards that they have to operate under. And it's pretty darn specific, because I can remember back in the early 2003-04, we had to make some adjustments on how we were doing things to make sure that as that standard was applied, we were doing the right thing so that the people could see it was properly accounted for. And the most recent one is forecasting that long-term liability and retirements, because it becomes a horrible surprise if a couple of decades later you go, whoops, the dollars aren't there. So again, that's just 2 points. Fresh eyes that have looked at a lot of other things, and then we're clearly a set of general standards that local government operating under.
Madam Chair, if I could
just a moment. Representative, look, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, because actually when you read the report, it wasn't an issue of kind of different accounting standards. What the legislative auditor pointed out is that each county has different things. So if you have a UNS office, that's different than another county down the road that doesn't have something like that. And a lot of them have maybe federal funds coming into that impacted how they do the auditing. So that was more the flavor that I got from the legislative auditors. But
yeah, I just wanted to make a correction. I think when I was making my comments about the difficulty of comparing, and I think I said state auditor, and I was meaning the report by the legislative auditor talked about the difficulty. It's easy to get confused, state auditor, legislative auditor, but and then you have different jurisdictions and different roles.
Members, any other questions? Is there anyone else from the audience that wishes to speak?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Deborah Erickson. I'm the Administrative Services Director here in Crow Wing County, and our Financial Services Division falls under our purveyance. I was the former elected Auditor Treasurer of Crow Wing County. We've had, as Mr. Cole mentioned, excellent relationships with the State Auditor's Office over the years, so this isn't, our comments are in no way reflective of that. In fact, our field staff is on site this week conducting our audit from 2015, and we've had nothing but good things to say about the staff that has come here. A couple of things I'd like to add to Mr. Poole's comments. Representative Carlson, you'd asked as far as the cost of what our annual audits have been. Historically, they've been about $70,000 to $75,000 a year. So that's typically what we have seen as our audit cost. Mr. Poole mentioned in his welcoming comments that one of our goals in Crow Wing County, or one of our values, is that we are looking to drive results and deliver value to our constituents, to our customers. And one of the ways that we've done that in financial services is making sure that we have the right staff that are going to provide the best value for the people of Crow Wing County. And one of the ways that we did that was by beefing up some of our accounting staff and actually hired a former state auditor's office employee who had worked with local government audits in the past. As part of the new responsibilities there, that staff member completes and prepares and delivers to the state auditor a completed CAFRA report, County Annual Financial Report, that gives a comprehensive view of all of our finances here in Crow Wing County. Prior to that, over the last couple of years, prior to her joining our staff, the state auditor's office prepared our financial statements for us. Part of our expectation with the addition of this value-added new staff person and now handing them completed financial reports was going to be a reduction in our costs, was going to be a reduction in the number of hours that was going to be needed, was going to be better value and materiality of the comments and the findings that were made with regard to our audit. And as of yet, that has not materialized for us. We haven't seen a huge reduction in the number of hours that's been submitted. We have not seen a reduction in our costs. In fact, costs continue to go up. We received the pricing list a couple of months ago for the 2016 audit cycle, and those costs have gone up again. As you noted in the OLA's response, it was notable, basically due to increased contract costs, so labor contracts that were settled. So those costs do continue to increase for us. And we just would like to have options like other counties have. We even have talked about the fact that our county board would like to have the same options that other county boards have for the purpose of selecting what is best for the people of Crow Wing County and what meets our needs. So that's just a few other comments to add to what Mr. Wolf had to say. Thank you.
Members, any questions at all? Ms. Erickson, thank you for that. Anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this issue? Seeing none, we appreciate the feedback. We will probably be in contact as we continue to look at this issue. I'm sure Representative Howe has some other issues on this issue matter going forward. So thank you so much for your time. Folks, we are next would like to do a review of some of our veteran issues. And I think Representative Howe and Ms. Roberts are going to help us out with that. Ms. Roberts, if you want to talk a little bit about kind of what we've had historically from the funding perspective, I think that would be helpful. And we've got a question. If you can come to the table so you can get it.
Very quick. For us old veterans who can't hear it, can we get the volume up?
Okay. Sure. I'll try and talk louder too. How's that? I'm sorry. What we're going to do now is Ms. Roberts, she's our financial analyst, and I've asked her to prepare kind of a historical perspective on veterans funding that we have. This is part of our responsibility in state government finance, and I thought it would be helpful for the people to kind of know where have we been and where are we going, and then I also asked Representative Howe to kind of go through some of the highlights from the last year. And then I want to open it up to you to see what kind of feedback that you have or questions that you might have after hearing kind of this information. So Ms. Roberts, if you can step to the front table and we'll all try and talk a little louder. I apologize, I wasn't leaning into the microphone, so let me know if it's still muffled, okay? Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair and members of the audience, I'm going to briefly be talking about the bar chart that was with the handouts in the front of the room. And what this chart represents is the state's general fund appropriations to the Department of Veterans Affairs since fiscal year 2004. So the department is funded through these general fund dollars as well as federal funds. Those are the two primary sources of funding for the department. The federal funds are in the form of patient per diems for the veterans homes and also funds for construction projects at the homes. So in recent years there's been an uptick in federal funding because of the construction at the Minneapolis campus. If you look at the chart, you'll see there's two different portions of the bar, and that reflects the two different areas of funding for the department. The first area is called Programs and Services, which provides services to assist veterans and their families in attaining federal and state benefits. So this area includes things like the State Soldiers Assistance Program, the grants to the county veteran service officers, higher education benefits, and state cemetery operations. So there, you'll see there's just a wide variety of things that fall under the programs and services area. The largest area of funding is the veterans health care area, which funds the five state veterans homes. And if you look at the chart, you can see that the trend over the past 14 years has been an increase in funding. And I think one thing to note is the funding commitment from the state to the department has always been in a positive direction, even in the years where other agencies have been cut when we've been facing budget shortfalls. The Department of Veterans Affairs has not faced those same cuts. So over, you'll see that in the 2013 session, there was an 8.5% increase over the previous biennium. And then in the 2015 session, there was a 13.2% increase over the previous biennium. Just real quickly, although if you look at the funding for fiscal year 2012 and 13, while it looks like there may be a dip in funding, this is really due to some one-time funding items that were approved by earlier legislatures. And the second chart, if you look at that, has some detail on those.
And over Ms. Roberts, on that year, it was actually an increase of, what, $2.8 million?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I don't know the dollar amount, but I know it was a 2.5% increase. And again, that was a session where the other agencies in this committee all received reductions. And in the last 4 years, there have been increases to both the services area and the veterans homes. In the 2013 session, the increases were primarily to the services area, And those included a permanent funding increase for the County Veteran Service Officers grants, and also permanent funding for the Honor Guards. In the last budget session in 2015, the legislature appropriated a $16.9 million increase for the veterans' homes. The department had requested this funding to cover increased operating costs and compensation costs at the home. So that's a real brief summary, but if you have any questions.
Hold there for a moment. Representative, how can you kind of go through the list of what we did in the last session while it's still happening now?
Yes, Madam Chair. And there was some very good legislation that went through the and they got passed last year. One of them was we've always had a struggle with veteran-owned businesses and getting those veteran-owned businesses certified through the federal process. What we did was we simplified that process, so now you've got, there's also a state certification process, so that if they, now they can get it, we kind of streamlined it so you can get certified by the state as a veteran-owned business and get, especially on state projects, a incentive, basically. I think it's a 6% incentive on your bid process in order to get the bid. So hopefully adding that will allow the veteran-owned business a kind of a leg up in the bidding process to get government jobs. That won't work for a federal job, but it does work for state bidding processes. Now, if there's any federal money into that job or that in that process, then the state certification will not work and you have to be federally certified. But for most of the state projects that don't have federal money involved, this process is really streamlined. And it's in conjunction with the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Administration that both work on this certification process. And I'm sure, I know Ben's here from the Department of Veterans Affairs. I don't know if you want to expound on that at all, or
Mr. Johnson, you can come to the table.
And while he's coming to the table, we also did something with the veterans, with local police departments. We authorized and funded de-escalation training for peace officers out there. So when we got the veterans that have the PTSD or are struggling with some issues out there that we've seen, we have more and more that we face, we actually funded that at $100,000 a year to provide training, de-escalation training for police officers, EMS folks, first responders, so they understand and have a better understanding on how to deal with veterans and how to de-escalate the situation instead of facing, like we have had in the past, some of that suicide by cop issues that we had. Hopefully we can address, this addresses some of that. And what we found is that this actually helps address many other aspects of our public out there that they may not be veterans, but now at least the police officers have a better understanding of what they're dealing with, and it, and with some more capability of de-escalating the situation rather than having it spiral out, they've got a better handle on how to deal with it.
Mr. Johnson, did you want to comment?
Madam Chair, I actually didn't have anything to add. I think Representative had a nice job sort of recapping what the Veterans Owned Small Business legislation does and how it functions.
Do we have any questions on that piece at all from any of the folks that are here today? Representative, how do you want to proceed?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so we also heard that we've had some veterans with some issues using the GI Bill, the state and the federal GI Bill. So what we tried to do there was streamline that process and eliminate some of that, those issues. And I think I haven't heard of anybody having a big hiccup in that, so I think we were pretty successful in doing so and streamlining that process. Some of the unfinished business that we're faced with right now is one of the
One of the big items is the Veterans Retirement Tax Reduction. And if you know anything about this issue, is we're one of six states that continue to tax veterans' retirement. And if you're a veteran that retires out of the, or gets out of the, retires out of the active component, they actually give you a list of veteran-friendly states. Minnesota remains one of those that aren't on the list. And if you look, many of our surrounding states, Wisconsin, South Dakota, who of course doesn't have any income tax, but Iowa, all have that tax exemption for veterans' retirement. And especially with Wisconsin, when we see when they change theirs, they recoup a lot of federal dollars to go into that state because they don't tax veterans' retirement. What they got coming in, what Wisconsin has coming into their state in those federal dollars dwarfs Minnesota's. And I think that's a big reason for it. And I think there was three bills that are currently in the tax bill that sits in conference committee currently. One of those was from Representative Heisman introduced. I believe that his was somewhere in the vicinity of, was it $2,000 for every year? Representative Heisman, what was your bill?
My bill exempted up to $20,000 annually in pension.
So it was $1,000 per year for 20 years. So basically, you'd be able, even if your retirement was only $14,000, you'd be able to exempt $20,000 of income. So a pretty good deal, and that sits in the tax bill in the conference committee currently. We hope that that's going to be successful. I know that it doesn't have everyone's support on the tax committee, but we hope that that's successful. We also, in the tax committee, have in that bill, an exemption to eliminate the Social Security, the tax on Social Security over a five-year period. So I think those two items there would be a big benefit for our senior folks. And I did hear a new term when we talk about veterans' retirement. I heard this the other day in the NAD meeting, Military Advisory Group, that it's second career veterans, because most of those veterans who retire are usually somewhere between 40 and 50 years old, come here and start a second career. And so they call them second career veterans and not retirees, because they really don't come here to retire, they come here for a second career. Another item that is in the tax bill that's not finished yet is a property tax reduction for veteran service organizations like our VFWs and our American Legions. Because we know that in the past 10 years, I think we're on an average losing 10 clubs a year that are closing, VFWs and American Legions, because we're having a tough time getting these new veterans into the clubs. So what this bill would do is it would reduce the property tax by a third for 10 years. And then in 10 years it would sunset, because myself being one of those folks, it took me about 10 years to figure out I wanted to go become a member of the VFW and Legion. And it seems like we have to solve that problem. It's not going to be solved overnight, but hopefully here we can get those younger veterans to join our VFWs and our Legions, get that membership up, and it seems like then we could sunset that and put the property tax bill back up or automatically sunset once we get those members in. So, Madam Chair, with that.
Representative Johnson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question as asked by a veteran in my community. Now, most veterans are not military retirees. What is the relationship between veterans and military retirees that get pensions? How many people, what percentage are we talking about? I assume most veterans aren't military retirees who would have this tax reduction.
Representative.
Is that true?
Or Mr. Johnson, maybe.
I think Mr. Johnson would probably have a better shot at answering that than I would.
Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Representative, the distinction in the state of Minnesota is we have approximately 369,000 veterans.
Mr. Johnson, if you can speak up.
Oh, sorry. We have, in the state of Minnesota, we estimate we have approximately 369,000 veterans. Okay. Of that group of veterans, only approximately 19,000 are military retirees receiving federal pension benefits for doing 20 or more years of service. So it's a much, the pension tax exemption is a much smaller, it addresses a much smaller population of veterans in the state.
So I understand correctly, so the 300,000 other veterans wouldn't get tax relief.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct. My understanding is that this applies specifically to those who have a retirement, have successfully completed 20 or more years and have retired from the military, federal service, or state service, and the National Guard, I think, would be included as well.
Well, Representative Hall, they would receive relief through the Social Security income tax.
Madam Chair, yes, they would. If that Social Security reduction would benefit those. The other piece is, and that's the reason that I think is a prime example, we've got 19,000 retirees, we'd sure like to see that increase. If I've got the availability of living in Iowa or Wisconsin, driving across the border, or Iowa, and just drive across the border, I think I'd much rather, I mean, that's, you're going to save somewhere between 15 and 30%, depending on what your tax bracket is, and why wouldn't you do that? So I think removing that, being one of six states, let's remove that, and let's allow people to come back to the state of Minnesota and have that second career here. So I think that's the big impetus. We want to fix that low number of veteran retirees here. So.
Representative Willick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's one of those that did retire from service in 1997. There was that comment about the list of tax-friendly and tax. There was a second list. They called tax-unfriendly states in my state. I was born and raised here. Was at the top of the list of the tax unfriendly. One of the issues with the 19,000 retirees from more than 20 years military services is the reason why that number is low. I am an absolute exception. I didn't decide to stay on the East Coast where my last duty station was. I didn't decide to go down to Texas or Florida or places or South Carolina, where they're using that as a recruiting tool, because I came back here at a fairly young age. I'm still young, but pushing not quite 70. But yeah, I started the second career here in Minnesota, and that's generally what all those folks do. It's sort of pushing them away. There's a reason why that number's so low. Because you know, all the services are this way. They want to make sure you're successful when you do retire. So they lay it on the line. They don't pull any punches. They go through in detail exactly what the implications are from a tax standpoint, from unemployment, from businesses, how friendly that state is in all aspects. They leave it up to you to decide whether you're going home or not. But they are absolutely honest. And it's sad to say that I can only go back to 96 because I retired early in 97. But yeah, Minnesota did not rank well. And that's a long time ago, and nothing's changed.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
I think a point there that Representative Bowie brings up is the military spends a lot of money training these folks for leadership and a technical skill. What a benefit that would be is to bring those folks here to use that, those expertise and that leadership, and help this state expound on that and start that second career here. I think it would be a big boon for us to bring those people here that currently don't choose to come here. I know I've got a friend of mine down in Huntsville, Alabama, that they don't tax any government pensions. And you look at that, and I'm sitting there thinking, I've got two of those, or I will, you know, once I retire out of the government, I have two of those. That would be a 15-20% increase in my retirement just by moving to a different state. Why would you do that? So I'm hoping you can stay. I'd rather stay here.
Yeah. And Mr. Olson, welcome. I understand you're the County Veteran Service Officer. Appreciate you coming today.
Thank you. Bob Nelson, Crow Wing County Veteran Service. I will venture a guess to say that one-third of those military retired personnel are former National Guard and Army Reserve people who lived throughout their entire career here in the state of Minnesota. And so that we don't have the numbers of retirees who were active duty military personnel who actually came home, I think we're really missing the boat on that. The other thing, I did want to make one comment. I have some appointments coming up, so I wanted to make this point that the funding for the de-escalation training, I participated in many of those de-escalation trainings at Camp Ripley. There was one yesterday that I participated in. And we have seen the direct results from our local law enforcement agencies where it has truly paid dividends. And the use of that training dollar and making our law enforcement and other services, our firemen and other people in that training, it has paid dividends. And thank you for appropriating that money so that that can be out there keeping an eye on our veterans, because it is truly something that's very worthwhile in my mind. And I didn't see that coming. But I'm sure glad it's there, because we've noticed it much more now than ever before, that some of our young soldiers are really struggling and they really need that. So thank you for appropriating that. And I hope that you continue to push forward for the retiree. I do get calls from service members who are getting ready to retire and thinking of coming home, and that's typically one of the questions. It's usually one of the top three. Do you tax my military pension? And I got all excited when somebody called me and said, somebody told me to fill out this form that I get tax relief. And then I went to that segment and read that for the $750 exclusion, and then I saw that the dollar amount would probably only qualify for about 10% of military retirees. The dollar level was very low. So I encourage you to continue to push for that. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And Mr. Nelson, I don't know if you had any other feedback at all that you wanted to share. I understand you have to get to another appointment since you got out of here.
I really appreciate the CBSO dollars, the things that are coming out. Dollars are really tight in counties, and offering the improvement grants have really been the thing that have kept us up with technology and moving things forward. Working with the VA, they're improving things as well and allowing us to keep up with their technology and making those things work so that it speeds up our claims and assists our veterans now that much better than before. The staffing of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs office, especially for us in the regional office, seeing them process and work those claims through, we're seeing that's really paying dividends getting those relationships with the staff down there at the VA. St. Paul is now head and shoulders above the rest of the nation in processing claims, and that's because of the support that we get from the legislature to get it, make sure that we have our training and make sure that we're keeping abreast of all the new changes and things that are going on. So that part really pays dividends. The staff at MDVA is very supportive of the local organizations and making sure that we're on top of things to sponsor training and make sure that we get accredited and make sure that we get the information that makes us be good service officers for our constituents and making sure that everything works well. So thank you for continued funding and support of that.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Representative Johnson. We have the Olson-Johnson, Nelson, Anderson contingency here. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Carlson.
Thank you, Carlson. Right. Just two quick questions. One is I'm curious as to what your assessment is of veteran homelessness in this part of the state. And secondly, I've heard some problems with dental care for veterans, and wondering if you've heard anything about oral health and dental care for veterans, and where that's a problem.
Mr. Nelson.
Representative Johnson, Madam Chair. Homelessness in our area is an issue, and it typically, we have lots of options for families and for women, but for single vets, it is an issue. The option is for us is get them a voucher from Salvation Army and put them up maybe one, and if we're lucky, a second night in a hotel. But the next option is put them on a bus or get them down to St. Cloud to the shelter. But that, if they're working and we have, let's say, an order of protection and everything, their whole support network is here in our local community, that is an issue. We're seeing a lot of that couch surfing and living in or just trying to stay off the streets. But that's an issue in rural Minnesota, and especially here in our area. We do use the services of Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans who do a great job in helping us find places. The problem is right now our rental rate the vacancy rate in our area is 1-2% vacancy in apartments. So if you're homeless and you have to find a place and your income's restricted, there's a 3-year wait list for Section 8 housing vouchers for a family in the Crow Wing County area. So, and they quit taking names. They quit taking names a year ago. So if you're a family and are homeless and are hoping that you might be able to get a voucher, there are no vouchers available. And about the only housing we have available for single vets might be in the high rise where you have to have a disability. So that's an issue for us in our area. Your other question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding dental care for our veterans? Okay.
Mr. Nelson.
The dental program from the state of Minnesota is a wonderful program, but we're starting to get people that are just above that. You know, an asset limit of $5,000 for a husband and wife, as people are starting to save for retirement or whatever, it's probably the one thing that I feel so sorry for some of them. The VA offers a dental program if you're 100% service-connected disabled, or if you meet that criteria for the state soldier assistance program, income for a husband and wife, $2,130 a month or less, or $5,000 a month, $5,000 in cash asset. Well, you know, if you're just inches above that, there's no hope. There is no program. There's nothing out there that offers that. The only options that we have is when it's absolutely a medical need. Sometimes a medical doctor will write a referral to the VA, but that might only include the veteran who just might be able to get basic dental care to take care of that abscess or just to get him over the hump, but doesn't solve the major issue. And, you know, I understand we have to have guidelines, and right now at the State of Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, those are firm guidelines. And while they should be, you know, but I would like to see them scrunched up just a little bit on that, but dollars are where they are, and they have to manage a budget, so guidelines are set. And we utilize that. I have to say that our county used last year close to $100,000 in special needs and state soldier assistance grants for optical dental. So we're very appreciative of that program, and we use it every week. And so it's there. Thank you for that as well.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, give me your evaluation. I know we've got the Allaire House down in the apartments down in St. Cloud, but I hear that they won't house anyone with a felony. And of course, how many of your homeless vets have one that you
I don't know if you try to utilize that housing down there, or is that a barrier to trying in your struggles to find housing for these folks?
Madam Chair, Representative Howell.
It's 60 miles away. And it is safe and sober housing, and we're opening up, there's another house that's opening up, but if you're employed here and having to drive back and forth, that's not an, that's, you know, I have a lot of working poor. A lot of people who are seasonal employees, you know, things are good in the summer when all of the people from the Twin Cities move our direction and want everything to be as it is at home, and we have people that are making beds and housekeeping and groundskeepers and doing all of those tasks during the summertime, and then during the wintertime we fold up the docks, we pull them out, and then they sit back and wait, and we have a lot of people that are, you know, we just don't have the availability. I know that there are housing grants out there, and we're studying those things, and what should the makeup of these buildings be, and can we do supportive housing? Fortunately, we have a VA clinic in town that supports our veterans. However, it does not have a social worker with the grade level high enough to meet the requirements to do some of the housing programs that we might support of housing that is available in other locales. And so it makes it difficult in rural Minnesota to find those options to get supportive housing, to meet with a social worker, to make those things happen. And so it does pose a problem for us. We keep looking for answers, and we look for housing solutions. There are some places out there that, one of the places that's been a blessing for us lately has been the Eagle's Healing Nest, which is in Sauk Center, which has taken some of our vets who are on the edge and really given them a place of hope and needs that almost like a group home setting to support their mental health conditions and be supportive housing is what's there. We just don't have that locally, and that would be wonderful. But the concerns of all is if you build it, they will come, and then is that the group that we want to attract? It isn't that we want to attract them, we just want to support them.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Councilor we have Representative Pugh. You can join us up here. Welcome. There's a spot here. I'm headed next to Representative Nelson. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Is there any other comments or questions or from the public on veteran issues at all? Welcome. Hi, if you could please state your name.
My name is Richard Ashman.
Richard Ashman?
Dick.
Dick, okay.
I'm a member of the American Legion. I will make a point on the terms of retiring. Hey, I was in the military, but not retired from the military. But you see these two gentlemen up here are volunteers. And these people that have come out of the service and the military, they have a good background. I know many of them that contributed well beyond their salaries and other things in terms of the services they provide. And I think that's one point that should be considered.
Thank you, Mr. Ashman. Any other questions or feedback? Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Michael Williams.
Michael Williams.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to let you know that thank you for all the things that you guys do for us veterans. I'm in one of the boats that Mr. Wilk here is on. I have to retire too, so I chose to stay in this state. But I'm thinking about moving. But just thank you for all your help. Appreciate it.
Nobody has legs like himself.
Yeah.
Anyone else wish to speak? Please come forward. We don't bite. Watch. Welcome. If you can please state your name.
I'm Darrell Bagel from Brainerd. And I hear all this talk about migration of veterans and bringing them to the state, but I haven't heard anything mentioned about lowering the license plate fees. Minnesota, I pay over $300 for my license. I can go to the neighboring states and get them for the vicinity of $50. Also, when I buy a new vehicle, I pay sales tax in Minnesota. There are states that does not charge sales tax to veterans, and that's all veterans. I think that should be taken into consideration.
Thank you.
And the other thing, railroad workers in Minnesota receive a tax exemption. Why don't veterans?
Okay. And Representative, I'm concerned about transportation. Have we done anything on the license plate? Have we heard some bills on that, or where are we at?
Well, in a time, and I was just going to make a comment on that, in a time where we're scrambling, looking for funds for transportation, because it seems that this transportation funding is a touchy point. Everybody's got a different line on how to fund transportation. Cutting some of those fees out is a touchy issue, because everybody wants an extra dollar to pay to fix a pothole or repair a road or a street. What we need to probably do is take a look and see what kind of a cost that would be to the transportation fund and how we're going to fill that hole once we take those dollars out. And I think that's the key that we have to identify, is what the cost of doing some of those are and how do we fill the hole once we pull those dollars out. I'm not saying it's not a great idea. I love it. It's just that everything comes with a cost, and especially when you're talking about those two items, that directly affects the transportation fund. It comes right out of that fund. So I've just got to figure out, if we put a bill together and we push that in the legislature, the question's going to come up, is how do we fill that void? And I like the idea. I think that we should do it. My problem is I got to find where we're going to come up with the dollars to fill the void. That's the only question I have. And if you've got a suggestion, I'm telling you what, I'm all ears, because if we can figure it out, let's get it done.
Well, the problem with that whole thing is all of that money that you're taking from the license plate fees and from driver's licenses, so on and so forth, you're pouring it into Metro Transit. You're not thinking of us in outer Minnesota.
The money that goes from the sales tax on automobiles, the majority of that goes in the Highway User Trust Fund, as well as the TAM fees that you're talking about going to the Highway User Trust Fund. And that is not used on transit in the metro area. That's not used to fund any transit. It's used to fund roads. And only can be, by constitution, used to fund roads.
Okay. Representative.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was just going to point out that question of Minnesota having higher tap fees has come up more than once, and you and I are members of the tax committee, and so a while back I looked into that issue and found out that many states do a separate billing under their personal property tax, of which Minnesota doesn't have one. And so what happens is you pay a very low rate on your license tabs, and then you get a separate bill for your personal property tax, of which your automobile is included and billed for separately. And a fellow that lived down the block from me was going to move to North Carolina, and he raised taxes general. And so I looked particularly at North Carolina. They had on your automobile a personal tax, property tax. They also charged a separate fee for their driver's education programs in North Carolina. And when you looked at all three of those charges, it became very comparable to Minnesota. So my only point is, if you're going to talk about that, we have to make sure we're comparing accurately the different states, because different states have different taxing mechanisms when it comes to an automobile.
And you gave a great idea that what we do then. Any issue, even if it doesn't, if we don't cover it here in state government finance, odds are one of us serves on a committee that deals with that issue, whether it's the tax committee or transportation committee. And so what we do when you guys provide us with this feedback is we'll go back and we'll talk to the committee chairs and to staff and get a better idea of what does that mean and feasibility and so forth. So I appreciate you offering that up. I'm certainly going to be talking to our tax chair and to our transportation finance chair on the issue. It's not a new issue, though. As you know, this has been something that Minnesotans have talked about for quite some time.
And Madam Chair, I just want to be clear that I'm just saying we have to be careful when we compare different states.
Right.
Yeah. We should have that debate internally with whatever the rates are here in Minnesota and how we charge in Minnesota. But to compare states, there's just a variance in terms of what's included in most.
They might have a tucked away sometimes, yeah. Anyone else? Is that somebody else that came up to it? Welcome. Please stay here.
Good afternoon. I'm Jason Warren, Officer 5, retired. Eugenie Holbrook.
Holbrook?
Holbrook. And I am one of the 19,000. I did retire in 2000 after being drafted in 1967 out of Brainerd. Grew up here. I chose to retire into Florida because they do not tax military retirement. Lived there for 2 years. Then I bought a home in Alabama because they don't retire tax retired income. Also had two daughters there and 11 grandkids in Alabama. However, I talked my wife into moving back up here in 2008. Still married, bought a home in Baxter, and she loves it up here. However, it's a little hard to say why we are living up here, not in Alabama. I have to write a check to Minnesota that's under $5,000 in April for taxes, which I really appreciate Minnesota. The VA is great in Minnesota. County's great. Minnesota offers tremendous benefits to the citizens here, and we enjoy it. But I look every year at how this is playing out, and I'd like to stay in Minnesota.
Well, we appreciate you sticking it out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to speak? Please come.
My name is Nancy Conley. My husband is a disabled vet. You hear a lot about the VA is wonderful and great, and even Bob was saying we have a great relationship, and I just know so many veterans that are treated so poorly. And it's across the board on most all that I see. You aren't going to see a lot of homeless. They are going to fall through. They have so many other problems on top of other problems. It's years and years and years of going through things. Dr. Bouchara, my husband's neurologist, was on, I can't remember what channel now because I'm nervous, on the news about the VA going through CMP exams and not even having qualified people do it. You heard Bob say that we don't even have a qualified shrink up here. It's appalling the way our veterans are treated. Everyone in government is letting every one of those men down. They fought for you. They have ruined their lives for you because of a lot of physical impairments they have. And they're being treated like a bunch of drunks, a bunch of druggies. And I guess I'm very angry about it. My husband has a service dog for his PTSD. He worked undercover for NIS. He also built nuclear bombs, so part of his brain is melting away, and he can't even do the things he did before. I finally got him 100% service connected, but it only took 9 years. And what are these guys doing? I mean, there's a whole snowball effect here, and they come home from Vietnam. They're spit on. They had multiple divorces. I know veterans children of veterans who've had to crawl on the floor because their dad's having flashbacks. I'll kill you if you make a sound because he's in the jungles. I know a veteran right now that came back from Iraq. He's always like, that's a good sniper spot. And he's over at our house. He's hallucinating. We joke when Paul and I go to the VA. And by the way, at the VA, you get treated like crap. They don't even say, hello, can we help you? Or we'll be right with you. It's kind of like we're all a bunch of drunks. And a lot of times they are because they have to come back and self-medicate. I guess I'm just here to say you guys don't hear the whole stories. My husband has a service dog in every single one of these veterans that has a service dog for their PTSD can tell you horror stories. I guess if you're going to do something for one veteran, like retire, you need to do it for all veterans. Because even that veteran that only served for 4 years in Vietnam, he sure deserves as much as a retiree does. I could go on forever, but thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Connolly.
Representative Connolly. I will say that, thank you, Madam Chair, but I will say that those of us that have served since Vietnam owe Vietnam veterans everything that we get today, because without you fighting and standing up to make sure that we weren't treated like you were, we'd still be treated like you. So, We owe the Vietnam veterans a great deal, and all I can say is thanks for being there for us.
Anyone else wish to speak?
Madam Chair, committee, retired Army Brigadier General Milton Murdoch.
Welcome.
I thank you very much for committed for your concern for veterans and your interest in what veterans are doing and what the situation is for veterans. I spent 40 years in the Army, 15 years of it active and major in the Minnesota National Guard. And I thank you very much, but one thing that concerns me as I stand here, I sit here listening, I hear talk about the benefits to our state, we were talking about that, all around here. What about honoring our veterans? What about honoring? Where's the talk about honoring our veterans? I agree with you. How many of us are sitting back here right now? Came out of Vietnam in 72 and 73, and we were told, have civilian clothing when you arrive in Los Angeles, because you can't wear a uniform on the street. Men have laid down their lives, picked up their bodies and body bags. Where's the talk of honor and veterans?
Thank you, Mr. Murdoch. And I'm guessing I can speak for the entire committee. We appreciate everyone that has served in the military, sacrifices that you've made, the sacrifices that your families have made and continue to make. I can't tell you enough how much it means to me to know that what you've done has allowed me to live a free life. That we have an opportunity here to be here today to have this kind of conversation. So I hope you know that. Thank you and welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Roger Ackerbitt from Brainerd. Is anybody aware of the Veterans Choice Program? It's broken. It's for veterans to get medical treatment under 30 days. Right now I'm waiting 60 days. I went to the patient advocate in St. Cloud file a complaint. He says, I have a whole pile of complaints exactly like yours. And I was one of the lucky ones to get an appointment under 60 days. He says, 90 days is the average. You call, you get these people, they don't know what you're talking about. They don't know where to go with your information. What I was told is the government threw all this money out at them. They weren't ready for it. They didn't have the personnel. And that's where they're sitting right now. The veterans are the ones that are paying for it. They're dying. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ackerbeck. You have echoed the same words that we heard in Albert Lea, in Owatonna, and other parts of the state. This is one of the reasons why we're having these hearings. Some of these issues fall under the federal government side of things. Even though we're the state government, we all have a commitment in talking to our congressional delegation on this issue. Also, Mr. Johnson is part of Minnesota's Veteran Affairs Office. We've asked him to be part of trying to address these issues. So you're not the first person to express that. Some of the comments that we got from the folks in Elkley and Owatonna suggested on allowing them to use local facilities to get care quicker and make it more convenient. So, I mean, those are some of the words of feedback that we've gotten from folks. And so any ideas that you have, too, we welcome those. But, yeah, unfortunately, you're not the first person to address that. And it's on our list of things that need to be taken care of. So thank you. Anyone else that wishes to speak up? Don't
be bothered, so. Ms. Scotty? What he was on, Nancy commented, that whole thing of going, being 50 miles away, my husband ended up with cancer also, of course, through all this. And we went down to the VA in St. Cloud to get blah, blah, blah. We wanted to go outside the VA because there was no way I was trusting my husband to the VA. And I'm very sorry, but a lot of us feel that. A lot of us, almost all of us feel that way. You are demeaned when you go there. And I says, I don't care if I have to spend the rest of my life paying out of pocket for my husband's cancer surgery, I'm not letting the VA touch him for that. It would have been nice to be able to use that 50-mile thing to pay for his cancer, because we're up here in Brainerd. According to the VA, we could have had the cancer surgery done down in Minneapolis, which is a lot more than 50 miles away. But we couldn't, and I'm sorry, and it's very heartbreaking. I just can't even begin to tell you guys that. And I guess you're hearing from some of us lowly people that have enough moxie to get up here and say this stuff. So many of these guys that don't have a wife that's a big mouth like me. My husband loves that. He goes, I would be dead right now if it wasn't for you. And I said, I will never let that happen. I will fight till my last breath. And now I want to keep fighting for other veterans.
Thank you, Ms. Conley. Mr. Johnson, did you want to comment?
I just wanted to respond to...
Sure.
If
you put into the microphone,
please. Ms. Connolly, I appreciate your candor, and I want you to know you're not the only one. And you talk about being the lowly people that people don't hear from. When we were in Pine City last week, Congressman Nolan had a representative from his office. He's the one who brought it up and said, we're tired of seeing this, and we're working to try and fix it. So I know it probably sounds like just empty words to you, but the state of Minnesota and the congressional delegation, they are hearing us, and they are trying to remedy this. Again, empty words, I'm sure, but we are communicating with them, trying to remedy it. So.
Well, that's part of the reason that we're here, so you don't have to travel to St. Paul. Right. To, yeah. Ms. Conn.
And just in the formalities, I was never in answering to that, I just got a total brain. What did you just say? I'm so sorry. I just.
I was just.
Oh, sure. I know now. The newscast that I was talking about with Dr. Bouchard, how the CMP people were being sent to people that weren't even in their specialty. You saw them for like a half hour, and that person decided your whole life after that. It was said from the VA, and I read it in print, that, well, that was before, and we were working very hard on it. Exactly 2 weeks ago, we went for this white matter. My husband's also 30% connected for the white matter, although it's taken whatever to prove that. But we saw a physician, and they were trying to determine between my white matter lesions on the brain or MS. And they wanted to know, the VA wanted to know the amount of white lesions versus white lesions from MS. You can't separate that in the brain, but that's what they want done. It's a physical, you can't do that. And the MS, anyway. We went and saw a doctor at St. Cloud for the CMP, and I specifically asked him, what are your qualifications for performing this exam? Are you a neurologist? Because only a neurologist can speak of MS or white matter lesions on the brain. And he says, I am a regular internal medicine doctor, but my wife has MS. That was 2 weeks ago. Just so you know, when you say we're working on this, you know they're still working on Agent Orange for Vietnam vets?
Right.
You guys are in the government, and I'm sorry, this is a little bit more of my opinion. Talk about all your terms. I think the best thing would be to limit you guys' terms. You guys go to the VA and have medical there instead of getting to, you know, instead of government. And I don't know what you all have. I'm just saying. I'm very upset. I am so upset with how our veterans are treated. The first time we went to the VA, my husband was so sick and throwing up, and the nurse at the emergency room in Minneapolis said, you need to sit down, wait till you sober up a little bit, we'll look at you in about 12 hours. And I said, really? I said, I'm going to start feeding my husband water so he throws up in every single chair here. I want someplace for him to lay down. And she came back, well, if he wouldn't be drinking so much, he wouldn't have that problem. Granted, my husband hasn't had a drink in 27 years, but that's how he had to self-medicate. But when the blood test came back, that, oh, you haven't had anything to drink, and he's like, yeah, I haven't had anything to drink, and I think it was 10 years at that time. But that's how you get treated at the VA. All the time. There are very few doctors there that actually treat you with respect. My husband had cancer surgery. We looked at each other and said, whoa, we're like treated like human beings in the hospital in St. Cloud. Not the VA hospital, the civilian hospital. It's an everyday occurrence. And I will stop talking about this. I swear I won't come up again.
Welcome, if you can please state your name for the record.
My name is Don Saxon. I only served 3 years, but I go to the VA for my medical. A couple of years ago, I went through the flu and having trouble breathing, so I went down to the VA, and they said, well, you might have asthma, you might have this. They gave me a bunch of different medication, and I had high blood pressure, so they gave me a blood pressure thing I could check. My heartbeat is usually 68, 67. I'm in pretty good shape. Well, for 3 months, my resting heartbeat was 93. I went in, I was having more difficulties. They wanted to change the medication. They checked my breathing. Oh, your breathing's fine. This is wonderful, you know. They gave me some more stuff. It got worse. I couldn't breathe. Finally, I made an appointment for the Brainerd facility up here. And I think it was like on a Thursday, I made the appointment for Monday. Well, Saturday night, I couldn't breathe or nothing, so I got taken into the emergency up here, and they did the test, and they said, well, you have pneumonia. And I said, well, really? Yeah, okay. So they gave me a bunch of medication and stuff, and they cleared it up. Well, I had called the VA ahead of time and said, well, I'm going in. Are you guys going to pay for this? Well, I'll send in the paperwork, and there should be no problem. Okay, well, I sent the paperwork in, and they said, well, no, you went to a civilian facility, and you have to pay. You know, they denied it the first time. I talked to our VA rep here, and he told me straight out. He just said, if you have any serious problems, an operation or something you're worried about, luckily, I have Medicare, too. So it didn't hurt too bad, but out of pocket, it cost me $500-$600 for the emergency room. And I was just very upset that over 3 months, and they took my blood pressure and they took my pulse, 3 months at 93, and trying different stuff. And then they called up to my doctor, the VA, and she called me while I was in the waiting room and said, well, your coughing might be due to your certain high blood pressure medication. Maybe we'll change your blood pressure medication. And I said, no. I said, that's not it. So I should have got a hold of a patient advocate. I don't know if it would have helped, but it really sucked. And I just figured I'd share that story with you, because that was only 2 years ago.
And that is very helpful. Those are the kinds of questions and stories that I get looking with. Mm-hmm. There's no way that you should have done something like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? We appreciate all of the feedback. We will be talking to our congressional delegation, Mr. Johnson. We will have a very lengthy conversation. If you didn't have a chance to talk today or didn't feel comfortable in this setting, do not hesitate to contact Representative Heisman, Representative Lewis, myself, any of the members on this committee. That's what we are here for. We are your voice in St. Paul, and so feel free to do any of that. And we just really appreciate your time and, again, your hospitality here in Brainerd. With that, we are adjourned.